It could all just end, of course. As the world and our worries grow darker by the day, it's strangely reassuring to ponder the end of the world, solving everything by wiping us out. Katie Mack, astrophysicist and cosmologist, is here in Australia at the end of the Earth to explain the end of the world. She has an encouraging list of possibilities from the Big Rip to vacuum decay. Dr. Mack is the expert on the big full stop. Katie, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Katie, we have guests here with wonderful titles, wonderful titles from all over the world, but I think yours is the best I've ever come across. You are the...
The Hawking Chair in Cosmology and Science Communication at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics.
In Canada.
In Canada.
Fantastic. Welcome to the show again.
Thank you.
Stephen Hawking, you came across the great theoretical physicist early on.
I did. I actually, the first time I met him, I think I was 16, I went to a public talk of his and just was blown away by these big ideas, the how space works, black holes, all of this kind of thing. And so I went on to study physics. And then I ran into him again in Cambridge when I was there for a visit during graduate school, doing some research on primordial black holes and cosmic strings and all sorts of things like that.
And he came to your lecture.
He did, yes. So when I was there for only about a month, I was giving a talk. I was asked to give a talk at the regular cosmology lunch, as all visitors are. And I was asked to speak on my research on primordial black holes. And I was very nervous because Hawking often went to these seminars and he basically invented the idea of primordial black holes that formed in the very early universe, tiny black holes that could evaporate and create detectable signals today. So I prepared my talk as usual, you know, everybody was setting up and here he comes rolling into the room with his minder and, you know, gets settled in the front row. And I started my talk, I gave my title and suddenly I heard, "Thank you," in this robotic voice coming from the front row. And I looked at him and I kind of laughed and I was like, well, I guess he's happy that I'm talking about his subject, and carried on. And over the course of the talk, there would be moments, apparently random, when he would say things like yes or no or I don't know or I don't think so.
Whoa.
And the whole time I was just terrified because I couldn't ask him to clarify, because at that time it took him a few minutes to form a sentence, you know, and so you can't just say like, oh, can you repeat that? What was that about? Because it would be quite an imposition. And so I had to just sort of pause and look at him and everybody just kind of went quiet for a bit. And then I would carry on with the talk, but I'm sweating bullets. You know, the whole faculty is there. He's making these comments. My childhood hero is there heckling me during a scientific talk. And at the end of the talk, you know, he was sort of, you know, he went away and I asked somebody, one of the graduate students, like, what was going on with Stephen Hawking? What was he trying to do? And they were like, oh, it's the lunch seminar and his voice activation thing, it looks at his cheek. He kind of like winks to choose words on his screen and it malfunctions when he's eating. And so it was just the quick select menu, you know, yes, no, thank you.
He was chewing the sandwich.
Yeah. He was just eating it. It would just randomly choose, you know, the common phrases and they can't turn it off because then he wouldn't be able to speak at all. So they just let him heckle.
But yet you've forgiven him.
Yes.
You've forgiven him.
Yes.
Katie, one of the things on Late Night Live is that we discreetly ask people to explain themselves because we think we know what they do.
Right.
We don't like to admit we don't really know what they do.
Right.
And we like to remind ourselves without embarrassing ourselves.
Of course.
The point I'm coming to is cosmologist.
Yes.
What is a cosmologist?
Okay, so cosmology is the study of the universe on the largest scales from beginning to end, how the universe works. So the fundamental physics behind the working of the universe, gravity and particle physics, and how it's evolved over time, how it went from the Big Bang to what we see today. So that's cosmology as a whole. And the work that I do is kind of trying to poke at some of those edges, trying to understand the components of the universe. As a theorist, I don't work with telescopes, but I talk to people who are coming up with new theories. I talk to people who are working on new telescopes, and I try to figure out how can we test new theories with new telescopes or new experiments, and how can we learn about what the universe is made of. So my main area of research is dark matter. So it's some kind of invisible stuff that is kind of binding the galaxy together. It's most of the matter in the universe is this invisible stuff we don't understand. And I'm interested in how it might have affected the first stars and galaxies and how we can use new telescopes to learn about it.
Right. So it's big focus stuff.
Yes.
Look, while you're here, can you help me with a couple of questions?
Sure.
Was there anything before the Big Bang?
That's an interesting question. So it depends on what you mean by the Big Bang.
Oh, what? That's just the Big Bang.
Well, so when you talk to a cosmologist, what we usually mean when we say the Big Bang is we mean the time in the very early universe when the universe was hot and dense and full of sort of plasma, and then it expanded and cooled and we got galaxies and things like that. But the thing that ignited that plasma, the thing that set off that expansion, that's still kind of a mystery. And we have some ideas about what might have happened. We have this idea that there was a very, very rapid period of expansion early on before that hot plasma stage, and we call that cosmic inflation. And we have a lot of theories about what might have happened then, but we don't know what the very beginning was. And I know that there's a common idea that there was a singularity, right? There was a point of infinite density and everything came out of that. But that's an idea that is a little bit, it's not that it's not favored, it's that we don't have evidence for it. There are certain ways to look at the equations that point to something like that, to a state of infinite density before this period of rapid expansion, but we're not sure if that happened. And if that happened, then there could be a sense in which there was no time before it, but we don't know. And so it's a little bit tricky. So we think that before the hot Big Bang, this stage of hot roiling plasma when everything
and
was very
dense. And you're confident there was a hot Big Bang.
We are very confident about that. That is really interesting because we can actually see it.
What?
Yeah. So this blows my mind every time. But it turns out when you look in the distance, you're looking into the past because light takes time to travel. And so the farther
away
you look.
Could you just say that again? Because it is absolutely fabulous. When you look into the distance,
you're looking into the past. Yeah. So every time you look at something far away, you're looking into the past because the light that you're receiving, the picture you're getting, took some time to get to you because light travels at a speed. It travels at the speed of light.
Even on Earth.
Even on Earth. I'm looking at you right now. You are 4 or 5 nanoseconds in the past, to my perspective.
I'm a lot further in the past than that, but go on.
Right. But everything you look at is in the past. And so we can actually look so far away that we can see the parts of the universe that are so far away from us that they are still in that hot Big Bang phase. They are still hot and glowing with plasma. We can see that glow. It turns out that it's because of the way the universe has been expanding, we see it as microwave light. So there's radio light, there's microwave light. It's all part of the electromagnetic spectrum. And so there's this microwave background light called the cosmic microwave background. And we pick it up with microwave receivers, either on Earth or in space. And there's this light, this glow all around us, everywhere in space. And that glow is there because if we look far enough in any direction, we can see the part of space that, from our perspective, is still in that primordial fire.
But now you're looking forward.
Now I'm really interested.
Can you do that as confidently?
No. But it's a lot of fun to think about. So I'm interested now in the future of the universe. What's going to happen in the far, far future, how the universe will end? Because we know it had a beginning of some kind. We know it's been evolving over time. And we know that that evolution is going to lead to something very, very different, some kind of ending. And I'm interested in what that might look like.
So, what might it look like?
Well,
and what are the clues for it?
Right. Yeah, well, there are several possibilities. So back in the 1960s, what people thought was that the universe would collapse someday. So it was found
itself.
Yeah. Yeah. So people knew that the universe was expanding, that, you know, distant galaxies are getting farther away from us. There's more and more space all the time. And so they thought, well, maybe it's going to expand for a while and then it's all going to fall back together. In the same way that if you throw a ball up into the air, you know, the gravity is pulling on it and it pulls it back down. And we thought, you know, the gravity of all these galaxies is going to pull everything back together and we'd end in a big crunch. And this was the leading idea in like the 1960s. But then in the 1990s, we did better measurements. We looked at the expansion history of the universe, the expansion rate, and we found out that the expansion wasn't slowing down. That the galaxies are not slowing down as they're moving away. They're actually speeding up, which is very weird. It's actually just as weird as if you throw a ball up into the air and it shoots off into space.
Catching speed as it goes.
Yeah. There had to be some kind of new physics creating that acceleration.
And has that new physics been identified?
We have a name for it.
Oh, that's great. You've got a name for it.
We have a name for it. We call it dark energy, but we don't know what it is. We don't know why it's there. We don't know how it works, but we know that there's something that is making the universe expand faster, and we call that dark energy. And
so that's not going to be the end of the universe.
It could be.
Could be. Okay. Yeah. How would that work to wreck us all?
Yeah. So the way that dark energy works is it makes the universe accelerate in its expansion. It kind of pushes everything apart. And it's just over time, if it continues the way it's going, it'll just keep emptying out the universe. It'll make the universe more spread out, more diffuse, colder, darker. And if that keeps going indefinitely, then you get to a point where everything kind of dies out. All the stars die out.
Sort of goes into a deep freeze.
Yeah. There's no, you know, one of the ways that stars form is that gas collides and creates these bursts of star formation when galaxies collide with each other and things like that. That's going to stop happening because everything's going to be so far apart. The stars that exist now are going to burn through all their fuel and die out. There's going to be black holes. The black holes might go through what's called Hawking evaporation, where they kind of fade away. They kind of burn out and fade away. And eventually matter will probably decay and everything will just be kind of, you know, fading out and falling apart. And there's a principle in physics called the second law of thermodynamics, which is the most technical thing I'll get into today.
Look, it's okay. I went to school.
Yes. So the second law of thermodynamics is this idea that disorder, or what we call entropy, increases in the future all the time. So, you know, if you try to, you know, build a building, over time it'll decay in some way. And that's true for everything in the universe. And over time you get to a point where all that's left is a little bit of disordered energy throughout the universe. And that's called the ultimate heat death of the universe.
Because by heat you mean bitter, deep, profound cold.
Yes, it's heat in this case means sort of disordered energy. So it is a very, very cold universe. It's an almost absolute zero cold universe, but that's the heat death, and that's what we think is probably the most likely end of the universe at this point, that it'll just kind of fade away and dissolve into entropy.
At an infinitely distant time.
Not infinitely distant, but very far in the future. Yes.
This is Late Night Live. I'm David Byron. I'm talking to Dr. Katie Mack about the end of the world, frankly. Yeah. Then there is some worry about being sucked into a vacuum.
What really happens with vacuum decay is the state of the universe, the kind of rules of the universe, the laws of physics might change. So the terminology here, we use the term vacuum to mean kind of the background state of the cosmos. Kind of think of it as the blank slate on which all of physics happens, right? So we live in a particular kind of vacuum here in our universe. And it's possible that that background state, the laws of physics that govern the universe, could change sometime in the future. And we know that's possible because they did change in the past. So we know that in the very, very, very early universe, the laws of physics were a little bit different.
How different? I mean,
well, we didn't have the same mix of particles that we have now, and particles didn't have mass. So it's all a very complicated story, but we have evidence for the idea that there was a change in the very, very early universe that changed the mix of particles that exist and to give mass to some of the particles that were out there.
And if that can happen once,
then it could, in principle, happen again. Something else could change to change the laws of physics and maybe make some particles too massive, or maybe, you know, make them not stick together anymore. That the laws of physics, the constants of nature could change if our vacuum state changes again. And this is an idea that's been around for a long time. It got a little bit more popular when the Higgs boson was detected at the Large Hadron Collider. So this was a very famous event in 2012 when the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva found a new particle called the Higgs boson. And people talked about that as like this was a particle that gave other particles mass in the early universe. And they were talking about this event that changed to give particles mass. And when that was discovered, we learned more about how the laws of physics work in our universe. We learned more about that event that happened in the very early universe. It was called symmetry breaking. It's a complicated story, but we learned more about how that happened. And we learned maybe it could happen again. The good news is that if it did, it's likely it would be just unfathomably far in the future. It would probably be, 10 to the power of 100 years or 10 to the power of 500 years in the future.
The human race isn't going to be around.
No. I mean, nothing interesting will be happening in the universe at that point.
You declare sitting here in 2025.
I'm just saying, we know based on the current expansion of the universe that in 100 billion years, it'll be so dark and empty we won't see other galaxies anymore.
Does this give you comfort when you look around the world today? Does this give you comfort that, one day it's all just going to end?
There's a sense in which it kind of does. I know that it's a little macabre, right, to think about the whole universe ending. And it does make me sad to think about the universe ending. I like the universe. I live here. All my friends are here. But it's also, there's a sense in which our little worries here on Earth are just so insignificant, and yet so precious because we're only here for a short time. The universe is not going to be around forever. There's no sort of great payoff in the end where everybody lives happily ever after in the scientific sense. People have different ideas about religious stuff, and I don't argue with that. But based on what we know about the physics, we have this little time, and we have this little time, and we need to find meaning in this little time that we have because someday it will be over.
Do you reckon we'll actually know how the universe works before it ends?
I don't know if we're ever going to have an ultimate theory. I don't know if we're ever going to be able to say we absolutely know everything. I think we are learning a lot. We have made some incredible discoveries in the last decade or so that I wouldn't have believed when I started my career. I mean, the discovery of gravitational waves is one example. Just an astonishing breakthrough. The ability to pick up on vibrations in space itself when black holes collide in other galaxies. That's what we're talking about. It's incredible, incredible technology, incredible science. And we're learning a lot about how gravity works, how black holes work, how other galaxies work. By building these incredible machines and measuring how space is stretching and squeezing as waves in space-time move through our solar system. Really incredible
stuff.
Do you
think we could employ some of this immense brain power to solving some of the problems here on Earth? I mean, it's all very well, Katie, to, discover how gravity moves through space. But, I mean, we've got wars going on and famines and disease and...
Yeah.
It's not a bit of a luxury, is it?
I don't think of it as a luxury. I do think of it as an investment in some senses.
Aha.
I think that basic research is an investment in the future, in future technologies, in future understanding. It's a way of trying to better understand our world so that we can find better ways to interact with it. If you look at the history of science, there have been countless stories of people just following their curiosity, saying, I want to understand this thing over here. Mm. And 50 years later, 100 years later, maybe even 10 years later, depending on the science, some new technology arises that makes people's lives better.
It's the accidental discoveries.
So many of those.
So beautiful.
And some of them are very much in my own field. I mean, there's an example from research here in Australia in radio astronomy where a scientist was looking for signals of primordial black holes, these tiny black holes that might have formed in the early universe, and they're hypothetical, they might not exist, but he was trying to understand them and trying to understand how we could detect them with radio waves, with these giant radio telescopes. He was trying to figure out how we would be able to tell the signal from other signals in the night sky and doing some mathematics around that, and ended up accidentally creating algorithms that now make Wi-Fi possible. Like, you know, things like that, you would never have guessed that studying primordial black holes, which might not even exist, it can't get more esoteric than that, right? Hypothetical black holes from the very beginning of the cosmos that might not exist. And then you create a technology that revolutionizes communication around the world.
You used the word investment, which yes. I thought was beautiful. But is that investment under threat at the moment?
It is in some places. Yeah. I think in many places.
Why?
I think that a lot of people don't understand the value of it. I think a lot of people see the outcome. They see, here's a company that builds a product, and we should give more money to the companies that are building the product. And they don't see that chain of discovery that starts with some graduate student in a lab in the middle of the night, banging their head against the wall, trying to get their calculations or their experiments to run. You know, you have to start with the basic curiosity. You have to start with the basic exploratory research. And that's the beginning of that chain. You can't go straight to the answer. You can't go straight to the industry and say, I'm just going to make that industry more powerful. It's like if you were living in the past and you said, I want to make the horse and buggy more efficient. And you put all of your money into that and you never figured out how to make cars or airplanes.
You never discover the internal combustion engine.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. You need to be able to follow curiosity in order to make the big breakthroughs, in order to, you know, really better understand the world and change it. But I do want to say, as much as that's, I think, the economic justification for doing blue sky research, for exploratory research, there is also just the fact that humans want to know things.
And I think we're a curious race.
We are a curious species. Like, we want to understand the world around
us. Species, yes.
We want to understand the world around us. We want to interact with the universe and know what we're doing, know where we came from. Like, we have to follow our curiosity because that's what drives us as people. It's a thing that people value as much as we value art and music and dance. You know, it's
curiosity.
It's something that drives us, that inspires us, that makes us want to keep going.
Drives this show.
Yes.
Drives this show.
Yes.
Before you go.
Yes.
I want to hear the story of how your grandfather saved the moon landing.
Okay. Yes. This is one of my favorite stories as well. So my grandfather, Captain Willard Samuel Houston, was a Navy captain. And during World War II, he worked on like meteorology, and he studied meteorology at Caltech, which is where I went to college. So I had a lot of common threads with him. I was really interested in science. He was really interested in science. And when NASA was doing the moon landings, they needed a meteorologist to just make sure that, you know, when the capsule came back, it wouldn't come into a storm, right? Because they had to make some predictions a few days ahead of time to be able to set the trajectory for the splashdown, because you have to make these plans, you know, quite early in order to
and
get
it
all
matters.
The, it matters a lot, yeah. And because it's coming down, and it's going to have parachutes, you know, you've got to make sure that it's good conditions. And so they asked him to check the site. And he had access to some secret spy satellite data because of his role in the military. So he was able to get some data that, you know, NASA wouldn't otherwise have access to. And he talked to some of his colleagues who had better access to this data than him, and just said that he needed to look at these pictures. And one of them grabbed him and said, "You have to see this." And it turned out there was a giant storm in the part of the ocean that they were planning to land in, and it wasn't showing up on the other pictures because the other data wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
But it was classified. It was a secret spy satellite. They couldn't let anybody know. And NASA,
not even NASA.
They're a civilian organization. They're not allowed to know these things. And so, so he had to go to his boss at NASA and say, it's 3 days before the landing. You have to move it. I cannot tell you why. And so,
and they did.
And they did. And they said, okay, we're going to do this, but we're going to send airplanes to the original landing site. And if there's not a storm there, you're in trouble. And so they made the trajectory changes. They had the capsule come down a few hundred kilometers away. It was fine. Perfectly normal. Landing went well. They sent some airplanes. And sure enough, they had a massive storm. It was the kind of storm that would have torn the parachutes right off the capsule. And can you imagine if Apollo 11, they landed on the moon, came back down, you know, everybody is celebrating, and they landed in the ocean and died. Could you imagine what that would have been like?
Katie, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you for having me.
I've been talking to Katie Mack, theoretical cosmologist, who holds, and I'm just dying to say this myself, the Hawking Chair in Cosmology and Science Communication at the Perimeter Institute in Canada. She's also the author of a book, The End of Everything, about what we have been discussing today. And next week, on Tuesday, she's going to be talking at Swinburne University. And on Wednesday, she will be talking at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne.